we're going to be finishing the last section in this first part of Megillat Esros, and it's rather an external topic in and of itself. It's a topic which relates just to an external kind of parallel, and the words we're going to be focusing on are based on all the thoughts that we're going to be focusing on are based on the thoughts of Rav Amnon Bazak, who is a teacher in Yeshivat Har Zion, which Bazak, B-A-Z-A-K.
Okay.
So he has a number of svarim on Nevi'im Rishonim, and some very interesting articles. And so this is the particular thoughts which he presented, and also in addition to that, just coming back a little bit to Rav Soloveitchik. Today the words are going to be starting with the thoughts of Rav Amnon Bazak in general, and also following up with some ideas from Rav Soloveitchik. And the points that we need to be aware of is that there are a number of textual, and also beyond the text, just in idea, parallels between Megillat Esros, the first part and last part, and Sefer Iyov. Sefer Iyov is one of the more particularly difficult Svarim Nach to learn. It's a very, besides psychologically and philosophically, but there's also just in general, the words, the discussions are difficult to understand. But there are a number of small foci we can point to. Number one is that we know that the overarching story of Iyov, as is described explicitly in Sefer Iyov, is where there's a particular individual, be it a existing individual or a particular individual in history, who was thriving, had everything he possibly could, and slowly things disappeared. Slowly things were taken away from him. And it started with his possessions. He was of enormous wealth. Then his family, and then his health. And a terrible descent into suffering. And a lot of the Sefer is taken up with the discussion between him and his close friends, and trying to understand his predicament. What is fascinating is that as we were going through the beginning of Megillat Esros, there's a similar trajectory. There's a similar process occurring with Naomi, right? As we see that Naomi starts off leaving Israel, leaving Beis Lechem in a state of wealth, in a state of what she calls meleah, full. She has children. She has wealth, as we described last week, and she leaves with all this, and slowly she loses it. And as the Malbim points out, that by the time that her husband passes on, he is called Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi. And the Malbim points out that because at this point he had no longer physical possessions, which is a very sad note in the sense of the spiraling down that precipice that the Malbim understands based on a number of Chazals that this similar thing happens. Their wealth, their family, or her family, Naomi is in a position in a similar flow that's going on with Iyov. But there's more than just the actual what goes on. There's actually a lot of the text itself seems to suggest that there's a parallel. Taking one step backwards, just before even getting to the further parallels, this is important for the following reason. When we started this series, and I'd like to just reiterate this example, is the following, when you look at a Sefer, when you look at a particular book, and we have a Megillah in front of us, a very short span of four prakim, the question is going to be, is this a historical relating? Is this telling us a particular time frame of what in the life of Naomi and Rus? Or is there an agenda? Is there what we call a plot? And just to appreciate, I'm just going to reiterate the same thing we started with 5 weeks ago, is if you were to take a look at the difference between the Time Machine as a book and as a movie, now not the recent 2002 edition of the movie, but the 1960s, that was a very well done movie of the Time Machine, for those of you familiar, and how it differs to the book. The book is when the inventor returns and tells his friends what occurred as he went in the time machine, and he went back a few years, and he went back even further, and he went forward, and he went into the very distant future, and all the events that occurred to him. That is really, we'll call it a time frame book. It's a few days, or it's hard to call them days because time's time's relative in the book. But the point is that it's a few episodes of what occurred in his life. There's no, not necessarily a plot. It's just a few random events which occurred during his time travel. Whereas the movie takes that same story and creates an argument around them. As he goes back and forward in time, there is an argument about the use of technology and warfare. And the question is, where is society really going? What is society trying to do? There's an argument and therefore cuts out a number of the details in the book. And it adds in a few other details in order to facilitate making an argument. So the question is, when we look at Megillas Rus, just to appreciate, what's the argument? What's the agenda? What's the plot? Where's this Megillah going to? What does it revolve around? What are the ideas which are making this Megillah tick? As opposed to just having a few ideas which are being given over to us, a few events. Because like the way the movie did to the book as our example, you will see therefore that the Megillah is going to leave out certain details and add certain details based on that argument. Okay, those are going to be the focus points or the focal points of the Megillah, depending on what the argument is. Okay, so coming back to that, we had a particular argument in our first year. There was a particular agenda. There was a particular plot. Today we're going to develop through these parallels to Eov another sense, another agenda of where the Megillah is going and what it revolves around. Leah, what were your thoughts?
The fact that the Megillah starts with that even though there's a book there is a whole sefer Tanakh that takes place during this time period, this is something different.
Correct. So meaning, as opposed to if Rus would have been four prakim within the greater book of Shoftim, it's very much an indication that this is its own unit with its own plot and with its own theme. Absolutely. So point well taken, and that just strengthens trying to understand its uniqueness and what it's doing by itself. Okay, so that should be the background as we move through this parallel, because this is going to open up an interesting vista into appreciating the Megillah as a whole. Okay, so that's just introductory remark. Now, moving backwards, we see stories which parallel the story of Eov and the story of Naomi, and it is something worthwhile thinking about that when the Talmud in Bava Basra describes who Eov could have possibly been, in which generation did he live? One of the conclusions that the Gemara presents is that Eov never really existed. Eov is a fictional character, but the point is what does it mean? Why is he fictional? The point is that he really lives in every generation. He is not limited to a specific time or place. Eov is a predicament. It is the human predicament. Okay, and this is an important point. And there are Eovs that one sees. There are Eovs that one sees in history. Eov is Eov is the concept, and it applies itself throughout history in which we see it. And it's man's questioning that situation. Now, when we move into Megillas Rus, Naomi may be an example of that. Naomi may be an example of that process of we'll call it the Eov process, at least at the beginning. Similar indications about this is, if you just wouldn't mind for one moment turning in the source books to page 8. This is the beginning of this Eov. There's a number of just interesting parallels which exist between Sefer Eov and Megillas Rus. This is midway down the page on page 8, under the heading Similarities. You'll notice that in Eov, when Eov reflects upon his situation, the words he uses are the following. Chai Kel, by the life of God, Hesir Mishpati, he removed my justice, V'Shakai Heimar Li. And the word Shakai, which is one of God's names, was bitter to me. Embittered my life. We recognize those words somewhat because of those very much the same words that Naomi uses when reflecting upon her own situation. As we saw at the end of the first parak, in the bottom of that box, Ani Melea Halachti, says Naomi, I left full. Hashem returned me empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Reflecting positiveness, beauty. Hashem Onavi. Hashem testified against me. V'shakai heira li. Hashem was, God was, or the same word, Shakai, was negative towards me. Very similar description when reflecting upon this situation. She borrows the same terms as Eov. That's parallel number one textually. Moreover, when it comes, that's how she relates to herself. How about the rest of society? How do the people relate to seeing Eov in his new predicament? We're told in Eov, this is in the second parak, this is in the last box in the part which is entitled Eov, parak Beis 11-12. Vayishmu shloshes re'ei Eov. The three friends of Eov heard. Eskol has hara hazos ha'ba'ala. They heard all the evil that had befallen him. Vayavo ishmim koma, and his friends each came from their place. Elifaz ha'temani u'bildad ha'shulchi v'tzofar ha'namasi. These three people from their respective places all came to Eov's aid. Vayivoadu yachdov lavo lanud loy ulanachamo. And they came to accompany him and to give a bestow upon him to nanachamo, give him compassion. Thank you. Vayisu esanei merachok v'lo hikiru. When they first arrived, they looked up and they saw him and they didn't even recognize him. They didn't recognize this was their friend Eov. Vayisu kolam v'kolam v'yivku. And they raised their voices and they wept. And they ripped their clothing in mourning, and they threw earth upwards to the heavens. So you can imagine, this is such a shock for them to see their friend Eov in such a state. They're completely confused. They're completely taken aback by the change of events. And isn't it interesting? That's almost the same thing that occurs with Naomi. As Naomi returns to Beis Lechem, what happens? If the whole town gathers around, Adbona Beis Lechem, until they came to Beis Lechem, Vayikavona Beis Lechem, as they enter Bethlehem, Vatehom Kola Ir Aleim, they're all in wonder. Vatomarna Hazos Naomi, is this Naomi? Right? This is the Naomi, as we described last week. This was the rich, compassionate lady who was the leader of the town, the one who everybody would come to in search of help, and now they see her walking back alone with nothing in rags. That's the vision, the paradigm shift, which their jaws drop in wonder. It's the same wonder that is being expressed by Eov's friends. So we've seen personally in terms of their personal reflection, in terms of society's reflection upon these two individuals. There's this wonder. There's this wonder which is being expressed. But moreover, the parallels, in fact, deepen, and in the good sense, thank God, is that at the end of the story, at the very end of the story, there are two positive parallels too. Not just in terms of what occurred to them at the beginning, but in the end of the day. In the end of Sefer Eov, we are told, this is on the top of page 9, in Perek 42, Membeis, Vayichi Eov acharezois, Me'ov v'arboim shana. After this incident, Eov lived another 140 years. From the new children of his new marriage after this incident, he was able to see four generations. An incredible blessing which we should all be able to see is that four generations is an incredible blessing. What are we told? This is very subtle. The Megillah ends with the following words. What about Naomi? Vatikrenu lo hashchenos shem lemor. When the son was born to Naomi, what did they call him? They said, Yulad Bain, not to Rus, but the Naomi. Naomi suddenly has a child now. They say that it's as if Naomi has her child. But Tikrenu Shmo Oved, they call him the Oved, who Avi Yishai, Avi David. Four generations. Isn't that interesting? In terms of the depth of the suffering which Naomi suffers, like Eov, the recovery afterwards is also that four parallel generations. And moreover, in the same sense of hope, when Eov talks about, when it's told about what happens to Eov just prior, Eov actually bears, in his new marriage, he's able to have seven boys and three girls. Similarly, by Naomi, in the last section of this, the fourth tier of this box on page 9, when they're blessing Rus to Naomi, they say, you will be to as a returner of spirit and to sustain your old age. Because Sorry, because you, the daughter-in-law which you loved has borne to you Asher Hitovaloch Mishiva Bodim, who's better to you than the seven sons. Whose seven sons? It's the Eos seven sons coming back again. It's the Eos sons coming back again. Both in the fall and the recovery, there is this parallel in terms of self-reflection, society's reflection, and in the recovery in terms of how society views her, in terms of the seven sons, and in terms of what she's able to see. Okay, and another interesting point just to realize, this is not relating specifically to Naomi, but it does say by Shlomo HaMelech that there was, this is in Sefer Melachim, that he had a seat behind him, La'em HaMalchus. La'em HaMalchus. And that on the Pshat level refers to his mother, Bathsheva. But the Mepharshim point out that this also could be a reference to Rus. Okay, to Rus, that relates on this incredible sense of linking to the future. And that does relate not specifically to Naomi, who's the character who has our Eov character, but more in general, you see this continuum, this, or the legacy post this era. There is. That's actually we've actually used a little bit of that, although I haven't explicitly showed it to you in Shir, but Rav Bachrach, Rav Yeshua Bachrach, who I draw upon a lot for some of the ideas, is got a sefer called Ima Shel Malchus, is the parallel, and it's been translated into English, in fact. So it's a very worthwhile sefer.
Yishai has seven sons and at least one daughter.
Correct.
Correct.
So it's interesting how that echoes throughout those continuing generations. But it's specifically fascinating that they say to Naomi that you who suffered will now be gaining there'll be a recovery more than seven sons, which is that those words are echoing the story of Eov. So the question is the following. Oh, actually, one last parallel, which is worthwhile noting, is that in that Gemara in Bava Basra, which describes who Eov could have possibly been, which generation did he live in? There's a number of suggestions that are brought to the table, and one of the suggestions is, this is in source 1, the Gemara in Bava Basra on page 9, D'Tanya, there is a Braisa, Rabbi Elazar Oimer. Rabbi Elazar would say, Eov bimei shvot hashoftim hoya. Eov lived in the days of the Shvot HaShoftim, which is the time of Megidas Rus, which is interesting. Where is Rav Elazar coming from? He quotes a pasuk and he talks about that there's a parallel pasuk in the Megillah. But conceptually, what does it mean that Eov came in the times of Shvot HaShoftim? Maybe what he is doing is identifying an Eov character in history. Maybe he's identifying an Eov character in history. Who's that character? None other than possibly Naomi. None other than Naomi herself. And the question that begs at this point in time is, if there are parallels in terms of the actual story, in terms of the way the text frames it, then what are we to make of that? What are we to make of that? Is there something relevant? Is there a contrast or is there a comparison? Are there both? That's the question which we need to address here, because every time you see parallels, and multiple parallels, there's an indication. What are we going to do with that indication? Where does it take us? What journeys are going to take us on? So before us lies a journey. Now, we're going to analyze Eov as a whole, which is definitely what we can do in the next 25 minutes, and Rus as a whole. So I'm going to just point out some insights, global insights into Sefer Eov, global insights into Megillas Rus, and see the differences. See the differences which these parallels are now holding together. Going to be holding together the differences in this. And as introducing Sefer Eov, it's just worthwhile pointing out again is that I don't mean in any way to speak presumptuously or arrogantly about this at all. I'm simply reflecting on some of the storyline details. And one treads on thin ice when analyzing this story as a whole. But I think it's important just to be able to appreciate it and how it contrasts Megillas Rus. So the story of Eov is an interesting one in the sense that the main character doesn't know what we know. The main character doesn't know what we know. What's that? At the beginning of the story, there's a conversation. The conversation is between God and the Satan, and the angel which prosecutes. And Hashem says, "Have you seen my boy Eov? Have you seen him? Look how well he's doing." And Satan says, Well, he was only doing so well because he gave him the wherewithal. Let's see what would happen if he didn't, if he wasn't doing so well. If he didn't have the means, maybe he wouldn't be as great as Avraham Avinu as you claimed, God. As Hashem says, okay, Hashem removes the layer. Then he says, well, look, he's doing well. He didn't question my actions in any way. And Satan says, well, you only took away so much. And slowly but surely the conversation ensues, and God takes away layer after layer of Eeyore's life until all that he's left with is a failing health and nothing else. No wealth, no family. Everything that he had, everything that he expected, this style of life he had, is no longer there. And the question is, and the test is he going to hold his same approach to life? Is he going to view God in the same way in the particular predicament where now Lola, he no longer has the have? The sad thing about it is, we know that conversation. He doesn't know that conversation. It's an incredible thing. Throughout the entire book, Eeyore's sitting there pondering with his friends, thinking how this could possibly be, and friend after friend suggests reasons why he's in this predicament. But they don't know what we know. And they know we know at least one aspect of where this started from. Certainly not the only reason, but it's the sad aspect of Eeyore. Now, it gets more than that, because if you're to, you know, when you watch a play, there's when you need to change scenes, they put different props in the background and the lights go out and there's a second curtain and that opens and then there's more props behind that and the lights change, so you gain a sense of the different scene. But then there's some plays you go to that the entire play exists in one room. So they don't need to change anything, and the point of it is really just the drama, is the conversation. Right, is what's going on within that room rather than necessarily the fancy changes. And those sometimes are even more profound. What's interesting about Eeyore is Eeyore's not so much about the change of scenery. It's the ivory tower. It's the wringing fists. It's the agonizing over the situation in Eeyore's room, really. That's most of the book of Eeyore and his friends suggesting this, his friends suggesting that. And Eeyore realizing that they can't be right. It can't be that their suggestions are tenable. And finally, Elihu at the end, who's the fourth part of this puzzle, who comes in and says that it cannot be for any reason. And at a certain point in this whole story, Eeyore breaks. There's a certain point where Eeyore blasphemes. He says that this cannot be possible. I've investigated all the possibilities. It cannot be possible that I'm suffering for a reason. And he turns against God in his response. And at that point in time, God steps in, and God says to him the following, and this is in source 2 here. I'm on page 9. Hashem says to him, and the translation's next to it in archaic English for those who prefer. Hayodato eis ledes yale sela. Do you know the birthing of the wild goats? Cholel ayalos tishmor. Or do you know when the hinds calve? Tispor yirachim tamalena. Do you know when the months are full? Hayodato eis ledeta, or the time that they bring forth? They bow themselves and bring out their young and cast out their fruit. The young ones are strong, they grow up in the field and go forth and do not return again. So God says, do you understand the inner workings of creation? Do you understand how the birthing process works just for these goats up on the mountain? And of course, Eeyore has no answer to that. And he continues this entire chapter where Hashem says, do you know about this? Do you know about that? Do you know how the inner workings of creation that you can even question the way I decided that that reality runs? Vayan Hashem es Eeyore. This is skipping to the next parak, but I just put the two together. Vayan Hashem es Eeyore vayomar. God answers Eeyore and says, Harov im shakai yisor. Will you argue with God? Will you argue with Hashem Almighty? Mochiach Elokai yaneno. He that argues with God, let him answer it. And Eeyore responds, Hein kalosi mashiveko. I am small, I'm nothing. What can I answer you? Yodi santi lamoth b'fi. I'm going to put my hand on my mouth. And Eeyore backs down. Eeyore backs down when God pronounces and puts him in perspective the runnings, the inner runnings of the world, as when Eeyore turned around. Achasti barti v'lo e'ene. Once I've spoken, I will not answer again. Ushtaim v'lo asif. I will go no further. And God then again reprimands him and says, "Are you in the place of God to be able to know what to know how the world works?" The story of Eov is a story of a proactive God and a reactive human being. Eov and his friends are reflecting on what occurred. They're sitting in the room, they're sitting in that one room, trying to work out philosophically what occurred, how this could occur. And when they don't understand, when they make the mistake, then God acts. God explains to him how everything works. God says, "This is the way the world works. Don't question me." It's the philosophical ivory tower in which Eov exists. And only, yes? God doesn't fully explain. But God explains why he can't understand. Yes, the answer is never explicit in Eov. That's perhaps part of it. Part of it is upholding the perspective of Elihu, the fourth friend, who said that it is not understandable. It can't be attributed to specific actions. Eov is about trying to understand, about thinking. Megillas Rus is not about thinking. Megillas Rus as a whole is not about what people think about their actions. It's about what people do. It's interesting that one of the larger motifs of the Megillah is the chesed. And there's no shortage of chesed, but just to point out in quick succession, six examples of the chesed throughout this Megillah. And chesed is, of course, human proactivity, human's investment in the story. There's six quick examples on page 10. At the beginning of Rus, Vatomer Naomi Lishnei Kaloseha. As they're walking out of Stei Moab, Naomi turns to her two daughters-in-law. She says, "Lech no shovna, return. Isha leveis ima, each woman to her mother's house. Ya'as Hashem imachem chesed. God should do to you chesed, ka'asher asisem ima meisim v'imadi. As God did with the dead, as you did chesed with the deceased, and you're doing with me." And we discussed what it meant that the chesed that they did to the deceased. She specifically labels their action as proactive, as doing, as the chesed they're doing. Moreover, when Boaz, what occurs next? Boaz, Vayan Boaz, this is in the second parak. Vayomer lo, who gadli. I was told, Kol asher osis es chamoseich, everything you did with your mother-in-law, acharei mosi sheikh, after the death of your husband, you left your father and mother's household and the land of your birthplace. Those are words which should parallel somebody in Tanakh. Right, so it's important to realize there's a parallel over there, that when he gives that blessing, he's saying you are Avram-esque. Okay, that's an important point for later on. Okay, that's the same parallel. The test that she underwent for this. Vatelchin, you went El Am Asher Lo Yodat Tumol Shel Shom, and you went after a nation which you knew not yesterday. Okay? So again, and this is the expression of what Boaz is hearing. Not only what Naomi sees, what Boaz sees. Look what she did. The chesed, the proactivity which Rus was involved with. Moreover, in source 6, Vatome Naomi Lekaloso, Baruch Hu LaHashem Asher Lo Azav Chasto Es HaChayim Ves HaMeisim. When Rus comes back, as we're going to see in the coming weeks, and she is found to be in the field of Boaz, and Boaz takes good care of her. She says, "Thank God that he did not abandon his kindness for the living and the dead." Who did not abandon? On the one hand, God, but on the other hand, Boaz. Boaz, remember, is the only person in society who's actually embraced them. Remember, last week, society carried on working. Everybody returned to the harvest. Boaz is the only one, albeit not at the beginning, but he's the only one who actually remembers them. There's the chesed of Boaz as well. Moving to source 7. Naomi says to Rus, "I'm interested in your own best interests. I hope that you find resting. I hope that you find your own husband as well. It's not just me that I'm interested in over here." 8. Vayomer Barucha Atol Hashem Biti, Heitav Tchasteich Achron Min Harishon. When Boaz sees that Rus is interested in creating a family with him to preserve the legacy of the dead Elimelech, what happens? He says to her, you are blessed because your second chesed is even greater than your first. You could have pursued the younger men. You're following me to preserve the memory of the deceased. And he calls that the chesed. And finally, Vayomer HaGoel, and the redeemer, the unnamed redeemer who's trying to preserve his legacy, thereby losing it, he says, Lo uchal ligol pen li pen sh'ash chesed nachlasi. He says to Boaz, I'm not interested in taking up this part, this responsibility. And he rejects. That's the diametric opposite of the Boaz Rus Naomi character in this is the Goel, is the redeemer who doesn't redeem. The one who wants to preserve his name and loses his name. Right? So that's the opposite. One of the motifs of the Megillah is Chesed. What is Chesed? Chesed is not about thinking about the situation so much as doing in the situation. It's a very different approach to perhaps the same situation. What does Naomi do? How does Naomi and her family deal with the situation? They do. They're not working out why. They're working out what. A very different approach, which is why it is interesting to think that in the Megillah, there is only two occurrences which are attributed to God. There are only two occurrences which are attributed to God. One is that the famine ends in Beis Lechem. God restores the food, which is not actually the centerpiece of the plot. The plot of what's going on with Naomi and Ruth is not part of that. And number two is that it says that God gave Ruth a child. Those are the only two times that it's mentioned. But the actual getting to that point is all in human hands. To the extent, which is a very puzzling sentence to see, is that when Ruth is looking for a place to gather grain, what does it say? It says that she happens upon the field of Boaz. She happens upon the field of Boaz. That's where you expect God to be there. That's where everything, that's the pivotal point, where she walks into the right place. She walks into the place where this is the family member who can possibly be the next link in fixing the whole story, and she happens to walk into the right place. The Midrash in Rus Rabbah says the following. The Midrash in Rus Rabbah says the following, drawing this theme to a whole. This is in source 10. Uboaz Allah Hashar. Boaz ascended to the gate. Vayoshev Sham Vihine Goel Over. And it happened to be that as he got to the gate, again, it happened to be that Mr. Goel was walking by. Asher Diber Boaz, and that which God Boaz is speaking about, Mala Achoret Tire Havakoim. The one he was talking about, look, he just happens to be here. Omer Vishmo Bar Nachman, Afilu Hoya Besof HaOlam. Even if he was at the very ends of the world, it's as if Hashem brought him right there. This Redeemer who Boaz needed to close the deal with, to see if you'd marry Rus or not, happened to be there. So that Boaz, that tzaddik, shouldn't be sitting there for one moment, wondering what's going to happen. Omar Rebbe Berechia, kach darshu. Rebbe Berechia says they had the following drasha, expounding. Shnei gedolei olam, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, who both usually arguing with one another, said the following. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Boaz also es shaloi. Boaz did what he needed to do. He was proactive. Rus asta es shaloi. Rus did her part of the saga. V'Naomi asta es shaloi. All these three characters did what they needed to do. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God says, Af ani I'll put in what I need to do. Vayomer sura shevo po uploni amoni. And look, uploni amoni happened to arrive at that point in time. The story of Rus, the story of Naomi, is not about thinking about the situation. It's not about philosophizing. It's not about trying to work out why God did this to Naomi. Naomi certainly reflects on it very briefly, but the next stage is doing. How are you going to get to the next stage? What are you going to do in the situation? And God says, when I see that, then I'm going to let it. It's obvious. They've set up all the cards in the right direction. The question is going to be, is all I need to do is just connect the electricity. That's all I need to do to this. There were some thoughts before we move to the next point.
It's a coincidence that Boaz's wife died and the funeral was the day that Ruth died.
Correct. Correct. So that's a part of that same plot as well, which was what we mentioned last week. Exactly that. That the Midrash mentions in that pasuk that there was that automatic connection.
When you talked about it, where Hashem mentioned, is there an idea that Boaz instituted saying Baruch Hashem?
Correct. So there's an interesting point which Boaz is instrumental in bringing God into the daily life in terms of the blessing, in terms of the form of blessing. I have to think about that as a further connection. But that is interesting how he brings into the actions. We're talking about the point of the actions here.
For all the similarities, though, I think they're very different for the reader, because Ruth, it starts off with all these bad things happening. You can't understand why they're happening. But by the end of the book, you see that there's actually a plan. And Eov, the whole point is, at the end of the book, you still don't...
Absolutely. So, it's very different in that sense. In terms of what you're pointing out, is not only in the way they deal with it, but in the way that in the answer that they get, right? Mm-hmm. In the end of Eov, you walk away not sure. You walk away wondering still why, even though there's a beautiful ending, mm-hmm. you still wonder why. Whereas in Rus, you see all the dots lined up. Right, that's a bit of it, just to enhance that difference. But this is so significant. This is so significant because let's just put one more piece of the puzzle, and then I want to come back to that point. What's interesting about the Eov story is that when does Hashem suddenly turn the wheel of fortune again? When does Hashem turn the wheel of fortune? If you wouldn't mind, I don't have this in the sources, but I'd like just to read to you what occurs in the last moments of Eov. I'd like to read to you, this is in for those of you who have a nach, this is in Perek Membeis. This is the very beginning of Perek Membeis, and listen to these words. Vayan Eov es Hashem, this is Perek Membeis, Pasuk Aleph. Eov responds to God, Vayomar, and he says, Yodati kechol tuchal v'lo yvotze mimcha mizima. God, I know you're all able. There's nothing that you cannot do. Total subservience to God. Mize ma'alim etza b'li da'as. Who is hiding any idea or advice without knowing it? Lochani garati v'lo avin. That's why I spoke, because I didn't understand. I spoke earlier because I didn't understand. Nifloos mimeni v'lo eida. These were hidden wonders from me which I didn't know. Shmano v'anachi adaber esholcha v'ahadieni. Please listen as I speak, and I will ask you, and you can tell me, because I know that you really know what's going on. L'shema ozen shematicha, just skipping to pasuks, and he talks about his lowly level as opposed to God. And then, vayhi achar diber Hashem es advarim ele el Yov. After God spoke to Eov, vayomer Hashem Eliphaz haTemani. God says to his friend Eliphaz, chara api b'cha v'shnei re'echa. I'm angry with you, the two friends who've been suggesting all these reasons for the suffering at the beginning. Ki loy dibartem elai nechona ka'avdi Eov. You didn't speak to me correctly, like Eov in the end spoke to me. You should now take 7 sacrifices, bulls and rams, and take them to my servant Eov. And you should bring them as a sacrifice on your behalf. And Eov, my servant, will pray on your behalf. If he prays to you, I'm not going to do anything bad to you. You didn't speak correctly in reference to my servant Eov. They go to him, and the words are the following. This is the words we close with in this section. They come to him, and it says, "V'Hashem shaves shavus Eov," and Hashem returned that which was taken away from Eov. When? When he prayed for his friends. When he prayed on behalf of his friends, then Hashem turned that wheel of fortune. And Hashem returned everything of Eov double. Isn't it interesting? The moment that Eov doesn't ask, but does, is the moment that the wheels turn. The moment that Eov takes that step of proactivity rather than philosophizing is the moment that there's an answer. And the answer isn't to the question that he asked. The answer isn't to the question that he asked. And for that, I'd just like to close with the words of Rav Soloveitchik. And this is really a profound statement. It's just 2 paragraphs, if you wouldn't mind. This is from a booklet called, or an essay called, Kol Dodi Dofek, The Voice of My Beloved Knocketh, published in the 50s. And it is as relevant as the moment it was written. It is as relevant as the moment it was written. Really, it's a very, very important, significant in terms of reflections on suffering as a whole, but in terms of obviously Israel, in terms of the significance of the state of Israel in our daily lives. It's really a beautiful read. And I just want to encapsulate in two paragraphs, two individuals, what he calls the man of fate and the man of destiny. For so long as a person grapples with the problem of evil, while still living an existence of fate, his relationship to this problem expresses itself only in a theoretical, philosophical approach. As a passive creature, the man of fate lacks the strength to struggle with evil in order to contain it, or in order to utilize it to achieve an exalted goal. For the I, subject to fate, is unable to affect any manner of consequence in the sphere of his own existence. He is nourished by his external environment, and his life bears the imprint of that environment. Therefore, he relates to evil from a non-practical standpoint and philosophizes about it from a purely speculative perspective. He wishes to deny the existence of evil and to create a harmonistic worldview. The end of such an effort can only be complete and total disillusionment, which is the lack of answer of Eov. Evil derides the captive of fate and his fantasy about a world which is wholly good and wholly beautiful. That's the one man. On the other hand, however, in the realm of destiny, man recognizes the world as it is and does not wish to use harmonistic formulas in order to gloss over and conceal evil. The man of destiny is highly realistic and does not flinch from confronting evil face to face. His approach is an ethico-halachic one, devoid of the slightest speculative metaphysical coloration. When the man of destiny suffers, he says to himself, evil exists, and I will neither deny it nor camouflage it with vain intellectual gymnastics. I am concerned about evil from a halachic standpoint, like a person who wishes to know the deed which he shall do. I ask one simple question. What must the sufferer do that he may live through the suffering? In this dimension, the center of gravity shifts from the causal and teleological perspective of evil to its practical one. The problem is now formulated in the straightforward halachic language and revolves about one's daily, quotidian tasks. The fundamental question is, what obligation does suffering impose upon man? The difference between the man of fate and the man of destiny. And that's exactly the parallels and the difference between the Naomi character, the Ruth and Naomi and Boaz team, as opposed to the Eov. They ask the question which cannot be answered. It cannot, in the end of the day, be answered because it's beyond the purview of our understanding. But when it comes to the doing, when it comes to being proactive within the situation, despite the fact that Naomi realizes the terrible nature of the situation, they take the situation and that is answered. They don't know why it occurred in the first place, but they see the result because God just had to connect the electricity to the circuit that they set up through their proactivity. That's the difference between the two. Very different models, and it's fascinating that the two are held together. We have these parallels in story. We have these parallels in text, holding the two together, two very disparate ideas and different approaches in the world, which are known to, in the words of Rav Soloveitchik, the man of fate and the man of destiny. Thank you very much, everybody. Just as...